Before we get started, I want to remind you that the DVD is now available of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. The DVD also contains the film itself, the Beaugest parody that the documentary is about. Here's how you get it. You go to my website, thecommentarytrack.com. You click on the videos page. That'll take you to PayPal. It's so easy. And once you buy it, and I know you will, let me know how you like it. Thanks.
The Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 48 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, Third Eye, out of the fog and into the smog. Got a great one for you today, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. Let's do a little housekeeping first. We really need some more support for this podcast. I beg for it every week, and I hope that it's going to bear fruit someday, that people will tell other people about it. And what I would really like is more word of mouth, and also going to iTunes and leaving a good review and a five-star rating. I was listening to another podcast the other day. I listen to several. I enjoy podcasts. And the host was saying that finally his contributions from listeners has gotten to the point where he could afford to rent office space so that he could always do his recording in the same place, and that he's got 2,000 recommendations on iTunes. I have 44 recommendations on iTunes. Now, granted, they're all highly complimentary. They're all five-star ratings. So I'm getting the cream of the crop. I'm getting people who really like the show. And what I need is around 1,800 more people to do the same thing. And I really hope that that will happen. It's very easy. You just go to iTunes, go to the commentary track section. You just put that in the search engine. It'll bring you right to it. And then it just says leave a review. So you just write down something along the lines of Frank Thompson is a genius, one of the leaders of the field, one of the greatest humans who ever lived. You know, just generally that sort of thing. And leave a five-star rating if you mean it. I mean, I don't want insincere five-star ratings, but please, come on. What else are you going to do? If you really think the podcast is awful, I just suggest you stop listening now and don't leave anything at iTunes at all, because that will just throw off the curve. But you can also go to the website and order books either directly from me. Got my books like The Alamo, A Cultural History, The Great Christmas Movies, The Star Film Ranch, many, many others that I have copies of myself and I can autograph for you if you order them. And if I don't have copies, you can order through the Amazon link and I'll get a little bit of a kickback. And I also have links for all of my guests so that you can order all of their books or videos or whatever they have. And I'll get a little bit of a kickback if you go through my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and order your books. You know you're going to order them anyway, so why not give me a little bit of a piece of the action? That's all I'm asking. It's really not too much. I'm standing here with my hat in my hand, just like Chick Sale in The Star Witness, which I just watched last night and is still on my mind. So, today's guest is Cheryl Rogers Barnett. Cheryl and I co-wrote a book a few years ago called Cowboy Princess, and it's about her life with her parents, Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. She became a real pal of mine and really enjoy spending time with Cheryl and her husband, Larry. And I have not seen her in quite a long time, probably a couple of years since we last ran into each other. So it was delightful to sit down in a hotel business office in Chatsworth, California, and catch up. Get stories about living with Roy and Dale and all of their many children and many pets. Also some good trigger stories and other things. So it's a really fun conversation. Hope you enjoy it, and we will see you on the other side.
I just never really heard many stories about her childhood, especially. After the book came out and after she passed away, I had occasion to talk with more of her cousins. they were saying that she actually started writing songs and plays when she was like 7 or 8 years old. She was doing this, and she would put them on for her family. Now, her grandparents, I guess, were rather scandalized because they were even stricter Southern Baptists than my grandmother was. But, I mean, she was incorrigible. And the cousins thought it was fantastic because they were all smaller than she was. She was the oldest, since my grandmother was the oldest. And, I mean, that just, I mean, what I was doing when I was 7 was playing jacks and hopscotch. I certainly wasn't writing plays and music. And I just, I mean, that just blows me away. And why she wouldn't have thought to tell us about something like that. Yeah. I mean, just like she never talked about the people that she worked with on the radio in Chicago. There were three, there was a trio, including Mom, and Nat King Cole, and Roger Carmichael, I believe it was. Either Roger Williams or Roger Carmichael, I can never remember which one. But they did all of the jingles for CBS Radio when she was there, and she never talked about working with them on a regular basis or anything. I mean, that just...
So even if Nat King Cole came on TV, she wouldn't say, oh, I used to work with them.
Or no, she said that she knew him.
Oh.
I knew that she knew him. But I had no idea that she was part of a trio with him that was doing anything. Yeah, I mean, stuff like that is just popping up all the time that I find out from other people that have done research on her and stuff. I mean, it.
Yeah, it never ends. I find in my work, no matter when I finish any given project, as soon as I do, I'll find more stuff about it that changes everything about what I thought I knew. So it never stops.
Yeah.
That's why you can never completely trust a history book or a biography, because it just represents what the author could find.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
There's always something else. So.
Yeah, well, you would think with your parents that you would have a pretty good handle on it. But as kids, I don't remember us asking a lot of questions. And thinking back on it, I don't remember my kids asking me a lot of questions about what it was like when I grew up, or even my grandkids. So I guess that's, you know, pretty normal, but...
I guess, but even, I would think for your kids, I mean, their grandparents were Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. It seems like they would be real interested in that, or was that just, they were just grandma and grandpa, and that was it?
They were grandma and grandpa. Now, they do love seeing the old videos and stuff like that, and I got them all copies of Trail of Robin Hood and the Outlaws of Paradise Valley episode of Dad's show that I was in, so they can see my wonderful career in show business.
Star-making role.
Yeah, I mean, they're so busy with their lives, and I think nowadays it's probably more so. When you read about the people that came across the prairie and stuff like that. I mean, they didn't have radio and television and cell phones and all of this stuff. So the family histories were, I think, passed down orally. And I think people actually knew more than we do now. We're so bombarded with current stuff, which is really a shame that we're sort of losing the past, I think.
I think we feel like because of the internet and all the information sources we have, that we can find anything we need, so therefore we don't have to really retain it. Or I think there are a lot of people who just don't know much because they figure, if I need to know it, I can just look it up on Google or something else. So yeah. I don't think people pay as close attention to things as they used to.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, you can find out so much. I just, a friend of mine sent me a bunch of stuff on mom's father's family, the Smiths, and it went back like five generations. They went on the LDS, one of the LDS ancestor things. But it doesn't tell you about the families. It just says who begat who type of thing. And that doesn't give you any details or tell you what they did or anything.
Sure. Yeah, you got to find letters or stories of some kind that fill
and
that stuff
in. And mom didn't keep any of that stuff.
How about your dad? Did he tell you a lot of stories about his childhood?
Just the ornery things that he did.
I can't believe he ever did anything ornery.
Oh, boy. He was so mischievous. And he talked about being the comedian in the Pioneer Trio and the Sons of the Pioneers when they first started out. He talked just a smidgen about that. But it wasn't until I saw a video, an old movie called Way Up Thar. It was a short, and Way Up Thar was a song that Bob Nolan wrote. They did that with... Oh, golly, I can't think of the people. But it was the Mack Sennett group that put together this video, and they're doing a radio show, a bunch of hillbillies. And Dad was so funny. I mean, I just... making crazy sounds, animal sounds and all, and funny faces, and... they were dressed like hillbillies and all, and he was so silly and funny for somebody so good looking. I think he could easily have been a comedian as well as the great musician that he was.
Do you remember him being funny around the house?
Oh yeah, I mean, he was a practical joker. In our book, I've got a picture of him hanging me up to the clothesline with those wooden clothes, the old-fashioned wooden clothespins. And that was him. I mean, he was just a scamp. He really was. Something I found out, though, after the book is that he and his cousin Stan started entertaining in the Portsmouth, Ohio area and Scioto County doing square dances. I knew that he was a fabulous square dance caller as an adult, but I had no idea that he had done anything in public until he came out to California and his sister got him up at a talent show. That, I mean, he was found more, I think, for his musician ability than his singing even. But to find out that he and Stan Sly were calling square dances when they were just little guys. Yeah, that was really surprising.
So both your parents really had childhood experience as entertainers.
Yeah. I mean... Well, I guess when you've got that kind of talent, that it does show up early.
Well, sure.
But they hadn't talked about that facet of their lives, so it's been really interesting to find that out.
When you get together with your brothers and sisters, does it ever seem like some of them got information and others didn't, or
that
you know things that your sister doesn't know and vice versa, that kind of thing?
Oh, sure. I mean, I told you that's one of the reasons Mom encouraged me to write our book, is that Dusty had written a book. And he had sat down and talked with people, and they'd put this together. And they actually came and talked to each of us siblings before they wrote Dusty's book and included some of our stories and all in there. But when Mimi and Linda Lou and I, who are within 3 years of the same age, when we would get together after Dusty's book, we'd say, you know, what house did he grow up in? So I think that's true. I've talked to a lot of other people, some of the Waynes and, you know, other showbiz kids. And we all pretty much had the same thing. Depending upon your age and your position in the family, you saw things differently because you came into their lives in different parts of their career. I think all families are like that.
Sure.
You know, especially if you've got an age difference. And we had a 26-year age span from Tommy to Dodie.
Yeah. That means your parents were very different people.
Oh, yeah. They were like grandparents when Dodie came along. I mean, she was really indulged because they had raised all of us.
Yeah.
And they were sort of, for them, semi-retired with Dodie. So Mom was actually able to go to things at school and all with Dodie and Debbie that they'd never been able to do when we were, you know, when the older, when we were kids, yeah. Because they were just mobbed at that time.
Sure.
And in Tommy's case, being the oldest of us, my grandparents really raised him because Mom was a band singer and she was on the road all the time. So he lived with them in Italy, Texas, while Mom was traveling all over the country.
Now, when you were a kid, both Roy and Dale were really famous. And yeah. So how did that affect your childhood? I mean, when you went to school and so forth, was it a good thing or a bad thing? Because I can see it going either way.
Well, it depends upon what it was. I mean, you know me. I'm an extrovert. So I derived, I think, a lot of benefits from it because I got to meet people and I got to travel and go places that if they hadn't have been who they were and what they did, that I wouldn't have had a chance to, you know, meet John Wayne and Clark Gable and some of the wonderful people that I got to meet and stay at the State House in Nashville and that type of thing. For a couple of my siblings who are extremely introverted, it was really, really, really difficult on them when they were little, especially. I mean, as adults, you get to where, you know, you can understand it more and all. But as little kids, I think they had a very difficult time. Dusty, especially being a junior, that was really tough. 'Cause boys are mean. Yeah. And I
think, contend that girls are mean too. So.
Well, they are, but in sort of a different way, I think. But in military school,
sure.
I can see where he had a really tough time being junior.
What about in your school? Did you get guff from your classmates or anything? Did they think
you
were Miss High and Mighty or something like that?
Well, I would hear that in the hall from people I didn't know. But no, it was more where, you know, if I walked in a classroom or something, they'd whinny or something like that. There was a lot more of that.
Sure.
than there was of the other. One of the things was that I changed schools constantly. They moved a lot. I think mainly because they were adopting more and more kids and we kept outgrowing the houses
yeah.
that we had. But also, just because Dad, growing up in farming country, I mean, I think the only thing they really raised were rocks. in Duck Run, Ohio. I mean, that was hard scrabble Appalachia where Dad grew up. But he wanted land. And so almost every house that we went to got more land. Not that the house was way bigger, but way more land associated with each house, because that was his dream.
And he liked to have livestock around. Did he have,
Did he have
more than horses?
Well, when they got married, they had 38 coon hounds on Ivorine in Hollywood.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we also had three or four baby raccoons that we raised that Dad came home with from one of his hunting trips. By the time we got to Encino, we had a fawn, we had a skunk, we had an opossum, we even had a mountain lion in a cage for a very short period of time. How he got that, I have no idea. We had a bunch of baby pheasants because Dad was going to go into business raising pheasants for the restaurants. He always had some kind of a scheme because he worked for a Poverty Row studio. He didn't make much money in show business. So he was always coming up with schemes to help afford all the kids he had. So pheasants were one. But there was a cold spell, and even though they were in a lighted, warmed area, they lost them all one very cold night. Rabbits, somebody gave him 4 rabbits. We soon had a freezer with 500 rabbits in it, even though he had given away rabbits to everybody that would take them. There's always stuff like that going on. We had cows and sheep. Yeah, we had Black Angus cows, and we had sheep there in Encino. By the time he got out to Chatsworth, he owned his own series, and he was the owner-producer of a series called Black Eagle, or Brave Eagle. Brave Eagle. And they shot that there at the ranch in Chatsworth. So he was too busy to have a lot of animals out there, but we still had horses and our own milk cow and some chickens.
We're in Chatsworth right now. So yes. How far away was your Chatsworth house from here?
Well,
I don't need an address, but how?
Yeah, I think he actually owned the property that this hotel sits
really?
On. He acquired that with a friend of his shortly before he moved out of the area. But we were just up Lassen, a couple of blocks,
wow.
Right next door to Oak Ridge Cemetery.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all been subdivided now. But it's funny. I lived not far from here when my kids were in high school. I lived over on Limerick. And my kids went to junior high and high school with a lot of kids who lived on Dad's old ranch.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we're only a hop, skip, and a jump from Iverson Ranch. And your dad certainly did some work up there,
oh,
too.
Yeah. Well, everybody that
sure.
made Westerns, sci-fi, Tarzan movies, everybody worked at Iverson.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's fun to still drive by it today. It's not what it was, but there's still a lot of Iverson there. And the Lone Ranger Rock is still there. I took Clayton to see it one time when we were writing that book.
Yeah.
And right across the road from the Iverson was the Spahn Ranch, which was where the Manson family lived.
Really infamous.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, we're at a historic place right now.
Yeah, well, right over the hill was Corriganville.
Sure.
Just down at the base on the other side of the hill. And Ray Corrigan had that for years, and then Bob Hope bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had a big fire in the Western Street, went bye-bye, darn it.
Well, they've never really done anything with Corriganville again. They rebuilt Melody Ranch. Is that what it's called? The Gene Autry town.
Yeah, that's Melody Ranch.
Because that burned down, too. But they've, or part of it did.
Parts of it did, yeah.
They rebuilt a lot of that. So
It's, oh, they do it all went from, kinds of work out there, oh, yeah. just constantly. The brothers that own it now, they've really marketed it fantastic.
Sure.
And they're doing stuff out there constantly.
I've always loved the idea that Gene Autry and Deadwood were shot on the same set. You could not get any farther apart in tone than that.
No, that's about as polar opposites yep. as possible.
Because even after I wrote the book with you, or we worked together on this book, I still sometimes get flummoxed when I try to trace the brothers and sisters and how they all came about. So now your dad's first wife was Arlene.
Yes.
And Roy and Arlene adopted you, and
right.
you were the first.
Yes.
So walk us through from that point.
Okay. They adopted me in 1940. Linda Lou was their daughter, and she was born in 43. They had Dusty in 46, Roy Jr., and she died when he was just a few days old. She had an aneurysm and died. Then he and Dale had been working together since 1943 is when they made Cowboy and the Senorita. So she had a grown son from a previous marriage. And she'd
been claiming that it was her brother, right?
Well, her agent made her do that. I mean, you know how awful Hollywood is, and I'm sure that
sure.
actors yeah. and actresses still face this problem. If you're young, since kids have to have teachers and social service workers and all of this, if they work on a project, if you're young-looking and can pass as a teenager, they'll keep you as young as possible for
sure.
years. Anyway, Mom's agent said that since she was already in her mid-20s when she came here, because she'd been a radio star and done big bands and all for years. Anyway, her agent convinced her to do that, and she talked to Tom, and he said he would never lie about it, but as long as nobody ever just out and out asked him if he was her son, that he would go along with it. But anyway, when he and Mom got married in 47, Tommy was already at SC and lived on campus there. So he never really lived with us. And it was a couple of years later in 49 that she got pregnant with Robin and had Robin in 50. She had Down syndrome, and she was only with us for 2 years. But living with a baby with that kind of a problem really changed their lives to a great extent. I mean, it was really a life-changing experience having Robin. And when Robin passed away 2 days before her second birthday, Mom had already seen my sister Dodie in Texas. She's from the same orphanage that I was from. Actually, it was called a foundling home back there because they just had babies. So Mom called and convinced them that she and Dad ought to be able to adopt Dodie, since Dodie was Choctaw and Dad was part Choctaw. So we got a call from Mom saying that she was bringing home a surprise from New York. This was in October, I believe. Robin had died the 1st of August. This was in October, and I had been in Texas, and I had visited the orphanage when I was there. So I knew that Mom was interested in Dodie, and I, you know, being the big sister, I said, oh, yeah, big surprise. She's coming home with an Indian baby. It was a big surprise. They stepped off of the airplane, and they had Sandy with them as well as Dodie. They had made a stop in Frankfort, Kentucky, and saw Sandy. Mom didn't want Dusty to be the only boy with all of these sisters, so they brought Sandy home with them on the same plane. Then mom got to worrying. Well, no, I'm out of order. Then mom and dad went to England and the British Isles with Billy Graham. They saw my sister Mimi there and invited her for the summer to come visit us. She's only 6 months younger than I am. We kept her. I mean, it was a whole bunch of stuff went in between, but I mean, we ended up getting her, they got her a student visa rather than just a visiting pass. And she went to school with us and married one of our classmates. And then my 16th birthday present was Debbie Lee from Korea.
Wow.
Yeah, because mom was worried about Dodie being so much darker skinned than the rest of us. And they were sponsoring like 40 babies and children through World Vision and a couple of the other groups that were around at that time with the foreign children, with GI babies and all. And so mom went through the list of all of the kids that they were already sponsoring and picked Debbie's picture, and Debbie joined the family in 56.
Wow. And how much turmoil was there among the other kids whenever a new one would come in? Was there resentment, or did they just sort of know what the drill was?
You know, I think mom and dad were wrong about Dusty not wanting to be the only boy in the family, because his first comment when Sandy got off the plane was, how long is he going to be here?
Well, in that picture of them being introduced, Dusty does not look pleased.
Yeah. No, I don't think he was real happy, because he was the prince.
Yeah.
As far as the ladies that took care of us went, being Roy Jr., and being the only boy with all the girls, I mean, that was a special place. But they adapted, you know, eventually. And with the rest of us, I don't know. I don't think Linda Lou and I ever, you know, I mean, mom and I had been at odds because dad had surprised us with a stepmother. And he'd made the mistake of telling me, as I say in the book, that I was in charge since I was the oldest, and I loved being in charge. Of course, I don't think the ladies that took care of us appreciated it very much. But anyway, I really didn't think that I needed a stepmother. So I gave her fits until she got pregnant with Robin. And I mean, the idea of a baby coming in, being female, I guess. I mean, I was thrilled. I thought that was great. And I think that Linda Lou did as well. And Linda she's quite introverted and very quiet, has a beautiful singing voice, just beautiful voice. But I think the only people that really hear her are the people in her church. She has a very generous spirit, and I don't know. I mean, she welcomed everybody in, I think. And Mimi had been raised in an orphanage, so she was used to having little ones around. And, yeah, I mean, we just, each one was a present.
Well, it seems like your parents both had such a devotion to children, not only to their own, but to children everywhere. Didn't you tell me that every time they went to a city to entertain, they'd go to the children's hospital first?
Oh, yeah. And the homes that dealt with handicapped children, that's where they found Sandy, was at a home for handicapped children in Frankfort, Kentucky. As an infant, I mean, I think he was only like 6 weeks old. He had been left in a motor court by his parents. At that time, he was the baby with three or four older siblings, but his parents had a bad drinking problem, and they left their kids all over the country. And they left Sandy because they thought they'd killed him. They had beaten him, and he had brain damage. And, I mean, it was...
They'd beaten him as a baby? I mean, yeah. He was just...
He'd cried, and they probably had hangovers or something. Who knows?
Sure.
But he was alone in that motor court room for, like, 3 days before anybody thought to see why the baby was continually crying.
Wow.
So he had a lot of problems when they brought him home. He had rickets, suffering from malnutrition, and one leg was longer than the other, and they had smashed the cartilage in his nose. So Mom and Dad brought him in and had his problems taken care of.
Well, as horrible a start as he had in life, he certainly lucked out with his adoptive parents, that's for sure.
Well, he just, like so many kids with problems, he had the greatest attitude I have ever seen. I mean, he woke up every morning with a smile on his face and hello world. And I think one of the cutest things was the Perry Como show. And he'd been with us for a couple of years at that point. In fact, more than just a couple, I guess. And each of us was to introduce ourselves, say where we were from and what our age was. And Sandy, however the order was that we were supposed to say, Sandy got it bass-ackwards. And it's just really a cute, sweet moment, and it shows his spirit and how he was.
Yeah.
He was open, and everybody liked him. I mean, you just couldn't help it.
Now, all the siblings that are around now, are they close by to you, or are they scattered all over the place?
We're spread all over the country.
Mm.
Yeah, Dodie's in Alabama, Dusty's in Missouri, Linda and Mimi are still in California, but Linda's up in Northern California and Mimi's in Wrightwood. Larry and I are now living in Utah.
Wow.
So we're scattered, but I mean, our kids are literally coast to coast and have been out of the country because, well, one of our daughters was in the Navy for 24 years. And so now that she's retired, she's finally back in the U.S., but she'd been all over. I've got a grandson that's in the Coast Guard, and he's been on the East Coast ever since he went with them. He's in Florida now and loves it. I have a great-granddaughter.
That's not possible.
And a great-granddaughter and a great-grandson that are on the way.
Wow.
We'll be here in October and November. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to like them very much, I bet.
Oh, no, of course not.
I can tell just by your attitude that you're not. Now, let's talk movies a little bit. How much did you get to hang around on the set with your parents?
A lot. Again, I'm the oldest. So, Dad, when I was little, he took me to Republic all the time. That was really sort of my nursery school and where I grew up. I thought it was magic because I got to go to class with the big kids. Not, you know, and I didn't think about it that way as a little bitty kid, as far as they had to be there because it was the law.
Sure.
And I got to be there and play school. So I thought that was just super fantastic. And of course, being able to go into the hairdressing part, and they would fix my hair, and I could go into makeup, and they'd let me play, and get the costume department. I mean, it was Disneyland before there was a Disneyland, so that was just wonderful. And I could be in New York 1 minute, and 5 minutes later walk over to another part of the studio and be in the Western set. Yeah. I mean, what little kid wouldn't love that?
Well, sure. What kids did you go to school with? Were they all kids who were acting in Republic Pictures?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, golly. Well, I remember Bob Blake and Jug Reynolds the best because I've known them as an adult. But oh, golly. I don't know. Whoever was working in Dad's pictures at the time, Tommy Ivo played Mom's son, the guy that did all the, I think, Dragsters, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not into that, but my husband is a car guy. Let's see who. I don't know. Republic wasn't doing the TV stuff.
So sure.
It's just the kids. Peter Miles played Mom's brother in one, so I know that he was there on that. And whatever kids were working with Dad, and what else were they shooting?
They didn't have a lot of contract kids at Republic anyway, did they? I mean,
I'm aware of.
Not like it's some, you know, Paramount had a huge school with lots and lots and lots of kids, but
yeah.
I don't think Republic had that many contract players as kids, anyway.
No, not child actors.
Yeah. What about the people who worked with your parents? Who do you remember best about from those, the co-stars and so forth?
Well, Penny Edwards, of course. Penny Edwards and Jane Frazee, because they were Dad's co-stars when Mom was expecting and when Mom was on suspension. Because Republic would never suspend Dad. Mom made more than Dad did. And so they would put her on suspension. They didn't want him marrying after Mommy died. So when they found out that he and Mom got married, they suspended her for a short time. And then when she got pregnant, that had not been in the studio's plans. And so she worked, oh golly, she worked for a lot of that pregnancy. But then when she had Robin, and Robin was sick, so Mom wanted, you know, she would get calls and she would leave the set. So that made them very unhappy. And so they suspended her for a while there. And yeah, but
it seems incredible that they just didn't know how to handle a woman who had just had a child. I mean, it seems like that would have worked into the system somehow.
No. Not back then. Not when the studios owned you. They did not care. And the ladies that hung in there, I mean, they were strong women. Most of them started out as just kids, you know, teenagers and young 20s. So many of them, even though they were very talented, if they got married as soon as they were pregnant, I mean, they were gone and off to a different life. And if they love show business, so many of them, I think, ended up doing little theater and stuff like that around. But the movies just had no patience with that, and there was such a continual supply of incredible, beautiful girls coming from all over the world to Hollywood to be made stars that the studios really, I mean, and I don't see that it's that different now. Back then, when the studios owned you, they would at least groom you and all. With Mom, she said the first thing they did was give her elocution lessons so that she could lose that "hi y'all" coming from Texas. But she took tap, she took ballroom. She had all kinds of lessons. Never took voice lessons. I mean, her voice was natural, and they didn't mess with her singing voice, thank heavens. And Dad, I mean, being a guy, I don't think he ever got lessons in anything, you know. I mean, they just assumed. that sure. he knew everything that he needed. But with some of the other actors, with some of the other studios, you would see guys that were the tough film noir guys, they'd throw them into a comedy or something, or they'd throw them into a musical, which would be a lot worse, and not all of them could sing, and most of them couldn't dance, but they still, you know, they used them a lot. But with women, I think the ladies that hung in there, they had to be really tough.
I think people who only know Dale from the westerns that she made would be surprised to see her earlier incarnation, because she was a real blonde bombshell at first. I mean, the first time you see her in films, and then you see pictures of her from the radio days and everything, she was very different from what Dale Evans would eventually be.
Oh yeah. Yeah, she was a natural redhead. And I've always thought that when the studio left her alone and kept her a redhead, because she had green hazel eyes and just gorgeous skin, no freckles. I had disgusting. And a waist that Dad, even though he wasn't a really big man, he could put his hands around her waist.
Wow.
And that was after Tommy. But she did a lot of dancing, and I
sure.
think that, you know, really helped. But, yeah, she was just beautiful. And even when she wasn't on suspension, she really didn't want to do Westerns. That her dream was to have been on Broadway and do musical comedy. That was what she wanted to do. Not the comedic part so much, but the musical part, definitely. Getting into Westerns was a fluke, and it's because she was from Texas that she ended up in Dad's movies. And they tested all of the ladies under contract to Republic at the time to see who would play against Dad the best, because Mr. Yates, who ran the studio, wanted to make Westerns like Oklahoma, which he loved. So Mom and Dad just looked fabulous on the screen together.
Sure.
And their voices worked really well with each other. So they asked her if she could ride a horse. And she didn't lie. She just said, "Well, I'm from Texas, aren't I?" And they assumed that that was a yes. So she immediately went out and took horseback riding lessons over at Griffith Park. But, yeah, I mean, the public loved them together. So she wanted out of Dad's movies, and they put her in, a dreadful film noir called The Trespasser. It's just horrid. Doug Foley, who is a bad guy, played the lead. So you know how bad that was. I mean, he was a great bad guy, but not as the romantic lead. And she did one with the guy who played Dagwood.
Arthur Lake.
She did a comedy with him. She was in another movie with Don Redberry. I think it was another film noir that she made with him. She did a really cute thing during the war that really showed off her legs and her figure. It was just absolutely adorable. I've seen a copy of it from Paramount's archives that is so cute. It's a horrible movie. It's really bad, but she was adorable. And then she did one with Joey Brown, Casanova in Burlesque,
mm-hmm.
that was all about Shakespeare. I mean, it was really hokey. She's a college girl, but she's got a couple of adorable numbers in it. And she was a redhead in that, and she was just drop-dead beautiful. just beautiful.
Yeah, it always struck me that she could have been like a Carol Lombard type or an mm-hmm. Alice Faye type or something like that if she hadn't taken the Western turn.
Yeah. Well, when she was first brought to Hollywood, it was with 20th Century Fox. And she had, she did a picture, and she had an option for another one. But they told her that since they already had a Betty Grable, that they weren't going to pick her option up. But I've got to say, I think she had a more pleasing voice than Betty Grable. She wasn't as good a dancer as Grable, but she was getting better all the time. And I think that, you know, if she had kept that up rather than going into the Westerns, that she could have easily rivaled, you know, any of the ladies that were doing the musicals at that time.
Sure.
She was so talented and just beautiful.
Yeah, I don't think she gets credit for having the voice that she had, because I just don't think people think of her as being like a real great singer, but she is. She's terrific.
Well, the big band stuff that she did. When she and Dad did alternated with Dinah Shore on the Chevy Show, and then for the few months that they had their own show on ABC, and she got to do a lot of big band numbers and stuff that was very currently popular at the time, her voice was just beautiful.
Yeah. Now, your dad, did he ever chafe at being Roy Rogers? Did he want to be something beyond that?
I don't think so. He was offered a chance, within a year or so of making Under Western Stars. And I don't remember which studio it was that went to Mr. Yates, and they wanted to pay a considerable amount of money to borrow Dad. And they were going to cast him against type and make him a heavy in a big budget movie where he would have been seen in theaters other than just those that showed B-movies and Westerns. And he turned it down. He said that he had established this persona, this Roy Rogers who was the good guy in the white hat, and that he thought it would confuse little kids to see him as the bad guy.
Hmm. So he decided that early on.
Really early on. And again, that was something that I hadn't realized so much until I read a couple of biographies of people that had really researched after he was gone. They researched stuff through, it's so hard to believe every newspaper article that you read and everything. But I remember Dad talking about turning it down, but I didn't realize how early in his career that it had been until I read other people's research. Then Larry and I, Dad had been long retired, and we had this huge family get together at my brother's house. And Larry and I had seen The Villain with Kirk Douglas, and we rented a tape. That's how long ago it was. We rented a tape, and we took it out to my brother's house and played it for all the grandchildren. And Dad was sitting with Larry and I watching this. And at the end of it, he turned over to Larry, and he says, "I wish they had asked me to do that." He wanted to be Wile E. Coyote. The Roadrunner was Dad's favorite cartoon, and he loved the Kirk Douglas role. And I can't imagine anybody thinking of him, but since it was so comedic, and, I mean, just a wonderful part. I mean, I think he would have seriously considered doing it.
Well, it's really too bad he didn't get more chances like that, especially to do broad comedy, which I think he would have really liked doing.
Yeah. Well, all the things that they guested on, Milton Berle, the Muppets, I mean, all of those shows, the Statler Brothers and Barbara Mandrell and all, I mean, he always would do little bits. And he did one on Dean Martin's show with Don Rickles that's really cute. And I was afraid, because Rickles, with that put-down humor, I was afraid that Dad would get really upset, where he was really silly. He didn't have a whole lot of sense of humor when it came to making fun of Roy Rogers. He loved Don Rickles. He absolutely loved him and had a ball working with him. So, I mean, what do I know? Nothing, obviously.
We should talk Trigger a little bit. I was watching Adventures of Robin Hood just a couple of weeks ago. And there he is with Olivia de Havilland riding him. And
wasn't he beautiful?
Just a beautiful young horse, and who knew what a future he would have.
But that was his job, to be the most beautiful horse in movies, and he did it really well.
Now, your dad actually bought Trigger for his own, right? I mean, wasn't there a little bit
right
of a struggle about that?
Right with the first movie, he negotiated with Hudkins Stables, who owned him, because he was a rental horse. And Dad said sometime later, I guess he had asked for a raise, or his agent on his behalf had asked for a raise, because Dad was making $75 a week. They were making a lot of money off of his movies. So Dad asked for a raise, and their reply was that they could put anybody on that horse and turn them into a star. Mm. And Dad says, no, you can't. I bought him. So he always credited Trigger with saving his career.
Well, he should. Now, Trigger even went with him on personal appearances, I mean, to the children's hospitals and things like that, right?
Well, that was the Trigger that Dad never admitted to owning.
Oh, the other Trigger.
The other Trigger. Dad realized really early that with using him as hard as they did, making the movies with all of the chases and the things that he did there, even though they had a double for the dangerous things, I mean, just the things they normally asked him to do were very wearing. And most cowboys, I mean, the older cowboys, they'd all had a bunch of horses, just like Gene did. There were a bunch of champions. But Dad didn't want to do that, and he wanted to save the old man, as they called him, as much as possible. So Dad had Glenn Randall looking for another Palomino. They found Little Trigger. I have no idea what that horse's background is, because I never saw a purchase thing for him. I never saw any registration, Palomino registration papers for him. Nothing. I don't even know where he came from. But Dad ended up with the smartest horse that any of the trainers had ever seen. Not necessarily the nicest one, because he was pretty darned ornery. But they could train him to do anything. He had well over 100 tricks. The only reason they stopped introducing new tricks was that they ran out of a place to touch him.
Wow.
Everywhere that you would touch him, he did something.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he was just incredible.
It's the same with me. Like,
bad. He was housebroken. That's a question in Trivial Pursuit.
I've always found that to be remarkable. They house trained him.
Well, everybody found that to be remarkable. I mean, the other trainers to this day, they say he was what? How did they do that? They did. They took him into Children's Hospital. They put rubber shoes on top of his horseshoes and took him into children's hospitals. He went up the steps of city halls all over the country. He flew to England. He went on the white ship to Hawaii. He was a well-traveled horse. Then when his legs started to go on him because of being trailered all over the country to rodeos and state fairs and all, when his legs started to go, Dad and Glenn started looking for another horse to back up the trick horse. They bought the horse that became Trigger Jr. They bought him in Pennsylvania. And he was a Tennessee walking horse. So here you've got Trigger, who's almost pure thoroughbred. Then you've got Little Trigger, who's a quarter horse. And then Trigger Jr. is a Tennessee walking horse. The only thing they had in common was that they were all Palominos. But Dad had three just fabulous horses.
How long did the first one live?
He was 33.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Little Trigger didn't make it quite that long, but he only died, I'd say, just a year or two before the old man. Hmm. And then Trigger Jr. was 32 or 33. These horses were well cared for.
Sure.
They were exercised even after they had retired. They still got exercise and all. And it always astonishes me when the PETA people and all, when they talk about your rodeo stock and those bucking horses. A lot of them live into their 30s because those horses are worth a lot of money, and they are really pampered. I mean, they are really taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people, I hate the circus for that reason, because I always feel like every time I see a trick, I always feel like, how did they hurt that animal to make it do that?
Yeah.
But the rodeo, I feel, is a different thing, because that's, that comes right out of work, like ranch working and farm working, and I think those animals are doing things that are natural to them.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think that's animal cruelty at all. I think that's just the way it works.
The circus,
I don't think so.
Well, Frank, when you see the Lepizzaners, those horses, the things they do are absolutely magnificent. But those horses, I mean, even as babies, you see them. And gated horses, because I rode a Paso, a Peruvian Paso, in the Rose Parade for 8 years. And they're born with that gait. It isn't something that comes unnatural or anything. And now, I understand that Glenn Randall was a little rough as a trainer goes. I never saw that as a kid, because I think he and Dad took care that. I mean, I saw them working, but I never saw Glenn abusing a horse. Trigger, maybe it's because he was so smart, Little Trigger. They would take something that he was doing naturally and encourage it.
Sure.
And that's how they got him to do most of the tricks that they did. I don't know. With the Lepizzaners, they work with their trainers forever. I mean, the same person rides them from when they're, just 4 year olds, I think, before they put a saddle and all on them. They let them be babies. But the things that they do are incredible, and it's mainly just through encouragement and all that they do. And I love going to their shows, because those horses are just incredible.
Yeah, I think that was almost always the case with, even with Hollywood animals, that because they were so valuable and because they were so trained, they were well taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Now you also see scenes like a movie like Charge of the Light Brigade. I can barely stand to watch that movie because of those falls that those horses make, which are clearly hurting them. I mean, there's just no way around it.
Well, back then, they didn't have the laws that they made later. And they could use, I forget what they call it, but they had a particular rope thing that they did that would, like, hobble the horse mid-stride or something and make them fall. Yeah. I mean, that was...
I was doing a DVD commentary track for an Errol Flynn film called Dodge City. I was going through all the records, and I found a memo saying, be careful with the horses. We don't want any more trouble from the Society of Prevention of Cruelty for Animals like we got for Charge of the Light Brigade. Because that was apparently a big deal. They really came after Warner Brothers big time for
good.
For what they had done.
Yeah,
and they just said, we don't want any more of that. So just take care of those horses.
Well, Dad always said that they took care of the horses on his films better than they did the actors because...
sure, they
I
did.
Mean, as you've known, all of the Western actors ended up with hearing aids.
Yeah.
All of them. And Dad said they always stuffed the horses' ears with cotton. And they did no protection for the cowboys at all.
Wow. It's really hard to believe, but I believe it. Because it's it was, especially those Poverty Row westerns and those things were made on the cheap and nobody really took care to do anything. So it's amazing to watch those things. And but that's part of the fun of them too. How the kind of rawness and the speed and fun of them.
They really were fun to watch. I love Turner. Because they put so many of just the super neat old movies on there. Not just the blockbusters, but they show everything else as well. And, oh, what a great job they do.
Yeah. Well, the B-Westerns that your parents made, that Gene Autry made, all those guys, John Wayne in his early time, there aren't many real masterpieces among them. But they're all just fun as they can be. And you sit down and watch one of those B-Westerns from 1941, and you're going to have fun. You're just going to have fun. It's not going to change your life, but you're going to have a good time while you're watching it.
What makes me sad, though, is that, I mean, now, several of Dad's, the movies that he made, and he made 88 films as Roy Rogers, I think just under 100 total films. And then I don't even know as far as TV stuff goes. Incredible. But so many of his movies are now ashes or vinegar because the B-Westerns don't really have the people out there other than Hoppe's, because he bought them early on. He was really farsighted, and he got his movies and preserved them. And then with Gene, he bought his. Dad said that he had 9 kids instead. So
it's a fair trade.
But there just doesn't seem to be anybody interested in preserving them. And I'm not talking about going in film or cell by cell or frame by frame and redoing them, because I know how expensive that is, since Larry and I raised the money to do Under Western Stars. Cost almost as much to redo it as it did to make it originally.
Wow, yep.
But just going in and making preservation copies, that type of thing. And with the old B-Westerns, I don't know anybody that's really doing that. And it's a darn shame, because when I was working for the Roy Rogers Dale Evans Museum, I would get calls from out of the country with people who were planning on coming to the U.S. on their vacations and whatever. They wanted to know where they could go to see cowboys. Because a lot of them were seeing our movies for the first time and thought that that's what the U.S. was.
Yeah.
Or at least the Western United States were all wide open frontier like that. But it does show... even though it's a Hollywood version of it, it does show our country's very unique heritage, that it was only for a short time in our history, but still it was just the U.S. in its infancy, and it was a wonderful time.
Yeah, and it's a good way to think about what our country was like, even if it was never quite like that.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood
did. It's nice to think it was.
Yeah, I mean, they romanticized it, but of course, now you have writers who are going in and putting words in the mouth of actors that were never used 150 years ago. And saying that, oh, no, this is the way it was. Well, nonsense. I mean, if you read their diaries and stuff like that, I mean,
yeah,
that isn't the way it was. I mean, it's another Hollywood version of the Old West.
Yeah. Yeah. Every movie is about the time it was made in as much as about the time that it's set in.
Exactly.
So you make a movie today and it's going to seem like today. That's all. No matter if you set it in 1650 or whatever, it's still going to seem like 2013. So,
yeah,
that's just the way it is. That's the way movies are. We should wrap it up pretty soon, but I wanted to...
We need to do an intro, Frank.
I do the intros elsewhere.
Oh, good.
Your parents never made a fortune at Republic or anything like that. They were never paid all that well. Did they do better when they got their TV show?
The people working for Dad did really well. I mean, I think the most that Dad ever made at Republic was like, I don't know, I think like $350 a week.
Wow.
Was
wow.
the most he ever made, and he had been number one box office for 11 years in a row. I mean, he was on the cover of a Life magazine. He was the only actor on that. Other than that, it was Lincoln and Babe Ruth. And,
wow.
I mean, yeah, you know. And he was a huge deal. I like to tell people, I mean, Mom and Dad were the Brad and Angelina of their day without the scandal.
Sure.
So where he ended up making money was in real estate. And he would buy dirt. I mean, he never wanted to develop it or do anything with it because he didn't understand that. And he had made so many disastrous investments over the years, or had other people make disastrous investments for him, which was usually the case, that by the time that he moved up to Apple Valley, he was just totally gun-shy of everything.
Yeah.
But he ended up there in Victorville area, buying a couple of pieces of property that he bought right, and he kept for a while, and made really good money on them. And he finally, right before he died, told my husband that for the first time in his life, he wasn't worried.
Wow. That's just amazing to me, to have such a huge movie star. And not only that, but somebody who was literally famous everywhere in the world, to have always had money problems like that.
You know, he had this, I mean, an incredible number of merchandise products out there.
Sure.
At the time, more than anybody. I mean, this was before Disney merchandised everything.
Sure.
But there were Roy Rogers flashlights, lunch boxes, pajamas, beds, dressers. I mean, it was just incredible. Roy Rogers, everything. But he wasn't the manufacturer. In fact, the guy that made the Roy Rogers jeans was the guy that owned the Rams, Rosenblum.
Oh.
He had a guy on his staff who oversaw all of the merchandising. And then, of course, the items were made by different companies. And Dad got a royalty, but he had to pay all the advertising and stuff like that. The manufacturers didn't pay that. Daddy did. And he had his own PR agent that kept his name out there. So he was paid, and he had his business manager, and he had his financial manager. And then they had another guy that only booked tours for them. And, of course, a couple of people at the house who took care of the house and took care of all of us kids. And, I mean, he supported a lot of people. And he never made that much. So some of the people that he had on salary ended up making more than he did.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, that was always incredible to me, even at the time, because by the time that I was 17, I did realize that. So that was really, I think he was always scrambling. Just, you know, and coming through the Depression, he did not believe in owing money to anybody. So he paid his houses off as soon as he could. I mean, he owned his cars because he was so afraid that, you know, if he missed a payment, everything would be gone otherwise.
Yeah.
And at the end, he liked to say that he didn't owe anybody anything, that what he had was his.
Well, we owe him a lot, and yeah. Your mom. And I owe you a lot for coming to do this. I really appreciate it. We have not seen each other in far too long, so it's really great catching up.
Well, once we moved to Utah,
yeah.
I mean, we absolutely love it.
I know Victorville was a long enough drive for me, but Utah.
I know, but you would love St. George.
Okay, I'll come.
It's beautiful. You guys should come see us. Larry likes to say that everywhere you look in our area, it looks like a John Wayne movie, because we live in the Red Rocks, and,
yeah.
You know, we live in Washington City, but St. George is the city that everybody knows, and we're just one exit up.
Well, we will be there one of these days. Count on that. So thanks a lot, Cheryl. It's really been fun.
Oh, had a ball.
I always get such a kick out of talking with Cheryl, and I hope that you enjoyed that, too. And I hope that you will check out her book, Cowboy Princess. There'll be a link on the Commentary Track website. Just go to the View More Details button on her page, and you'll see how to order it straight from Amazon. It's a fun book. Tells a lot of great stories about how she grew up with Roy and Dale and that brood of brothers and sisters. They seem to number in the hundreds. They blot out the sun with their numbers. Lots of them. I always enjoy spending time with Cheryl, and I hope that we will be able to do it again one of these days. Again, want to urge you to go to the website and order books and videos through the Amazon links there. And more important, the most important, is ordering a DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. It just this weekend, I'm recording this September 15th, 2013, if you're listening in the distant future, just this weekend, it had its film festival debut at the Skyline Indie Film Fest in Virginia. I have not heard from anybody yet, which I am assuming means that angry villagers threw the print into the sea after seeing it. But I'm holding out a glimmer of hope that somebody there liked it too. I know that if you order the DVD, you're going to like it. I can guarantee it. I can only guarantee it verbally, though. I mean, there's really no way. What am I legally liable? I don't know. But I hope that you will like it, and I remain pretty confident that you will like it. So I hope that you'll order one. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my great music, fore and aft, and James Hutchins, who designed my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit them both, not only to order books and videos, but also just to catch up with the news and see what other things are going on, or read my bio and be astonished at how much bad TV I've worked on in my lifetime, and other things. There's much of interest on those websites, so I hope that you will visit. Got another good one coming up next week, although I haven't decided exactly who that will be. I really need to do more scheduling, I guess, but I have 5 or 6 interviews in the can, if you'll pardon my French, and I will select who will make a good follow-up. I think I know who, but I'm not going to make any promises. You get me? So anyway, you'll find out when you find out next week when it shows up in your iTunes subscription, and you'll say, oh, that's who it is. That's now he's made his decision, and you'll like it. I guarantee it. I've got some good ones coming up. So until then, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.